Hello everyone, welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. I am your host, Lachlan Peters. Now this particular episode represents an effort to recap some of the major events, characters and themes of the series so far. It's a bonus episode. If you feel on top of the story, consider it optional. But more than 3 years ago now, I released the initial introductory episode, focused on the context of Cambodia in the early 1970s, as the war in neighbouring Vietnam spilled across its borders, culminating in a victory for the mysterious Khmer Rouge, and the beginning of one of the most radical and deadly societal upheavals of the 20th century. But that was more or less a teaser for that era of Cambodian history, and what is the eventual focus of this series. Since then, I've made an effort to begin explaining the Khmer Rouge Revolution by looking back about as far as possible, touching on the earliest components of Cambodian history, as well as those influences that came from the region of Southeast Asia and beyond. A confluence of forces and circumstances that I've come to call the hurricane of history, as both foreign pressures and internal patterns begin to combine over centuries and decades, eventually resulting in the devastation of the Khmer Rouge regime. But we're not quite there yet. The series currently rests at the end of one era and the beginning of another, as Cambodia officially ends its period of French colonial dominance under the control of Norodom Sihanouk in 1955, just 2 decades away from the nightmare that will engulf the country and its people. As the independence of Cambodia represented something akin to the end of a long chapter, I've decided to mark this point in the series as the end of Season 1, and the direct lead-up to the Khmer Rouge Revolution, the crystallization of their ideology, their path to power, and the role of the Cold War, as well as the regime itself, will form Season 2. So the next 10 or 15 episodes will detail about 25 years of history, whereas the 15 or so episodes that have led to this point covered about 2,500 years of history. Before getting into this episode, I just want to briefly restate the purpose of this series and my aims for it. I'm thinking that some listeners, new to the show, might take the opportunity to skip over the first couple of thousand years of the story and about 20 hours of content, to just begin here, more or less at the start of the rise and fall of the Khmer Rouge. Totally fine. Many people are interested predominantly with that part of the story, particularly those that might be familiar with how it relates to the Vietnam War, for instance. But hopefully this episode, if you do decide to start from here, will at least give a basic understanding of the content that has been discussed thus far, as naturally it is relevant. You know, there was a reason that I included the rest of the story, rather than just starting with the modern history and the lead-up to the Khmer Rouge period. The first reason is quite obvious. The podcast became a series about Cambodia as well, not just its darkest era, meaning that this is a Cambodian history podcast, although it is focused on explaining one particular aspect of that history. The second reason why I decided to pull it back so far is due to some of my own ways of looking at the world and history. I'm interested in the philosophical idea of determinism, where previously existing causes determine any current event. I think even a brief examination of one's own life can illustrate some of this in action, where seemingly random or coincidental factors that occurred decades earlier tend to stack up into a journey which has led to where you now sit or stand or walk as you listen to this. I think, in relation to Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge, I'm certainly not saying that this was an inevitability. It wasn't destiny that it was going to occur the way it did. Many different things had to come together to get to that set of circumstances. So, in a similar way, when it comes time to ask myself where to begin telling the story of the Khmer Rouge, it was hard for me to argue that it should start anywhere else but with the earliest groups of people that would eventually become known as the Khmer, or Khmai, to pronounce it more accurately, living in and around the region that we now call Cambodia many thousands of years ago. Now, as for the aims of the show, generally speaking, I've tried to make this series as accessible as possible. You can begin listening to this with no idea where Cambodia is on the map, and complete ignorance of what happened there in the mid-1970s. On the other end of the spectrum, however, I've had people get in contact with me who have, you know, written books about Cambodia, saying that they are still getting something out of listening to this podcast. So I try and strike a balance there for those that know a lot and those that know next to nothing. So I would hope that by the end of this series, and particularly if you have started from the beginning, you will know all of the major themes and events in Cambodian history, and have a relatively deep understanding of the Khmer Rouge Revolution and the circumstances that arose in the region and the world that allowed it to take place, and why it was a ruthless, paranoid, radical, and murderous regime. This series, depending on your perspective, could be thought of as an introduction into Cambodian history itself, or as a self-contained attempt to explain certain aspects of that history. It's an attempt to explain why more than 2 million people died at the hands of their own government. It's not a task that I take lightly. I believe that the suffering of Cambodia and its people at that time deserves a full explanation. The sources for the show include dozens of books, biographies, articles, and testimonies, as well as a few interviews that I've been able to conduct with prominent experts and historians of the subject. The usual appreciation for supporters of the show will take place toward the end, as well as some other housekeeping matters, including some exclusive content that has come out recently. So if you're interested, stick around for that. Otherwise, if you've been a regular listener, I hope this bonus episode will refresh your memory for the rest of the series. And if you're new and beginning here, then I thank you for giving the show a go, and I hope you'll find some value in what is to come. Okay, so before we go back and list all the big things that we've covered so far, I feel it might be good to just start with revisiting some of the wider themes that we've tried to establish so far, as they will form the basis of our explanation of the Khmer Rouge period as well. The first theme comes from the simple geographical location of Cambodia, and the circumstances that arise from this location and its accessibility. For several hundred years, Cambodia has been wedged between what we today call Thailand and Vietnam. As we will cover in just a moment, factors arising from this relationship between these two more powerful neighbours for the most part will have a large role to play in how Cambodian rulers set their political agendas. Another theme is the relationship of Cambodians to their past. The perception of the Angkorian era as a kind of cultural zenith, and subsequent periods as a regression from or decline from that period, as well as how these ideas relate to the so-called Khmer race, and how leaders will utilize that narrative, is also important. The style of Cambodian leadership is also another theme. For instance, the legacy of the Deva Raja, or the God Kings of Angkor, the patronage networks that underpin that leadership, and the Theravada Buddhist idea of merit, and how that situates those in power and those outside of it in Cambodia. So let's try and summarize those three themes. So, along the lines of Cambodia's relationship with its neighboring countries, its relationship with a narrative of its own history, and a political culture that stresses the importance of certain kinds of leadership. These themes play out in different ways over the centuries and from decade to decade, but they are generally what I consider to be one half of the so-called historical hurricane. And just to reiterate what I'm trying to do with that metaphor, relying on some surely half-baked understanding of meteorology, I take these themes as the internal, or at most the regional forces, that comprise the warm, moist weather patterns or pressures, the energy that's emanating from Cambodia itself, which will eventually combine violently with the cold and dry weather that travels from foreign lands. So what are those? Well, we can break the first foreign theme up into a few different aspects, but we could generally say that European colonization is vitally important. In particular, the French variant of that colonization, with its ideas related to the Enlightenment, Revolution, and the style of French imperialism. Cambodia will be part of what was known as French Indochina for the better part of a century, and many ideas will be baked into the culture during that time, not to mention the historical factors that will lead much of the region into bitter wars to gain independence from the French Empire. Related to this first foreign theme, but perhaps in a different way, is the spread of certain ideas that originate in Europe to other parts of the globe, including Southeast Asia, namely Marxism and its Leninist, Stalinist, and then Maoist variants. The prism in which the Vietnamese also interpret this ideology and pass it on to their Cambodian comrades is also worth putting in this category. Lastly, and again, more than slightly related to the previous two foreign themes, is the wider context of international relations, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. The role of the United States, the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, what we could simply term the Cold War, the way that their dealings will play out in Southeast Asia, is naturally a huge influence on this historical hurricane, developing in the way it develops, and when it does so. In the context of the series so far, as we approach the ramping up of the Cold War in particular, some of these themes have only weakly appeared, some strongly, while others have not begun to combine fully. For instance, the relationship between Cambodian notions of race and the past have not fully come into friction with the relationship with Vietnam, communist ideological variants, or indeed the circumstances of Cold War factions. While others, such as Cambodian cultural norms associated with politics or leadership, can be shown to have entwined in different ways with French colonization and subsequent decolonization. But eventually, all of these themes will have interacted or have some consequence or some interaction previously that will produce conditions that nearly annihilate Cambodia. Alright, so with those themes in mind, I want to go over some of the story so far in order to set up the next season of the podcast. As I said earlier, I do want you to be able to step into this with no prior knowledge. So in order to explain that first theme, relating to geography, let's begin with some basics of the region of Cambodia and the early history of a people who were living there, the Khmer. This region of mainland Southeast Asia, a relatively flat land with rich soil and access to both the sea and a massive inland lake known as the Tonle Sap. This area we now come to call Cambodia, well, it's been home to people who can be demonstrated to have spoken languages related to modern-day Khmer since at least the beginning of the Christian era. These people were influenced by the proto-Indian states to the west, in a process referred to as Indianization, placing the Khmer and their customs more on the Indian side than the Chinese side in regard to Indochina. You could consider the area of Cambodia as a kind of cultural fault line between the two larger civilizations and with influences from each. Eventually, a mighty Khmer kingdom would arise around the region of the Great Lake, which is in the northwest of the country's current borders. The relationship that this kingdom maintained with water and the seasons is of special importance. Cambodia is part of what we would call monsoon Asia, where the seasons can be simplified to the wet and the dry. When it's wet, it's wet, and when it's dry, it's dry. Generally speaking, the dry season runs through from December until June, reaching its hot and dry peak in April, and the rainy season runs from June until November. As wet rice agriculture is the region's most important food resource, the ability of the Khmer to form a commanding relationship with the climate and water in order to produce enough food to support an empire, is one of their crowning achievements. What we now call the Angkorian period, with the beautiful skeletal remains of its former capital city still visible outside of Siem Reap. This was built upon a complex and sprawling network of water management infrastructure. Like the roads that connect a modern-day city, the system of canals, dams, and reservoirs served to alter the natural flow of rain and floodwaters in a way that could maintain the largest city in the pre-industrial world. Recent estimates have placed the population at its height between 700 to 900,000 inhabitants. Archaeologists have been able to utilize powerful new technologies in order to map out this network of water management, but also the finer details of the city that we call Angkor, from the old foundations of houses, markets, and smaller temples, to the ponds that families may have shared as a means of escaping the heat. Angkor was much more than the beautiful stone temple mountains that remain today. However, those temples do represent a magnificent accomplishment. Perhaps the most famous of these, Angkor Wat, has been called an elaborate, ritual, symbolic, and cosmological construct. A vast temple pyramid surrounded by a moat, it remains the largest religious structure in the world, and represents the five-peaked mountain at the center of all the universes in Hindu mythology. Perhaps the most famous of the Angkorian kings was Jayavarman VII, who, upon coronation in 1181, began a wide series of construction projects and reforms that served to centralize the state around his walled city of Angkor Thom and the incredible many-faced temple of the Bayon that lays within it. Jayavarman built extensive roads across the empire, many other temples and reservoirs, as well as hospitals and additions to older temples. He is remembered as a great king, but his reign is somewhat contradictory. He was a devout Buddhist, and he saw the people of his kingdom as some part of his own merit-making mission. He was sympathetic toward them, yet it's hard not to imagine the hundreds of thousands of people that had to be used in such massive laborious projects. According to David Chandler, over the 30 or so years of his reign, he stamped the kingdom with his personality and ideas as no other ruler was able to do before Norodom Sihanouk in the 1960s and Pol Pot later on. Like these two figures, Jayavarman may have wanted to transform Cambodia and perceived himself as the instrument of that transformation. End quote. From the 11th to 14th centuries, the Khmer Empire dominated most of mainland Southeast Asia, far beyond Cambodia's current borders. It was well established within a network of trade and diplomacy that extended across Asia. The Chinese official Zhou Daguan, who visited the kingdom in 1296, went on to write an account which has become one of the only, and therefore highly important, first-hand sources of information about life at Angkor. He covers a great deal, from market stall etiquette, the activities of women, what were the valued items of trade, conditions of slavery, religion, the different punishments for crime, and the ability of the kingdom to produce multiple rice harvests per year. However, as historians and archaeologists lack much else except the remaining inscriptions carved into sections of stone temples, there is a mix of appreciating what he gives us and lamenting what he does not. One aspect of culture in the kingdom that he does convey, and one certainly reinforced by the sheer scale of monuments built for them, is the relationship of the king to the people. He describes a procession of their, as he calls it, supreme ruler, with hundreds of women from the palace carrying gold and silver, and ministers and officials and members of the royal family riding elephants, and eventually the king himself with a golden sword and the tusks of the elephant encased in gold. All of this illustrating that ceremonial Cambodian life and the hierarchies involved would actually change little between these times and in the hundreds of years that followed. But it was not all smooth sailing for the Khmer, and Zhou Daguan points out that there were wars being waged with the previously subjugated peoples who would eventually form the Kingdom of Siam. The rise of this kingdom, as well as successive invasions from it, would be one factor that scholars used to point toward as a kind of collapse of the Khmer Empire in 1431. However, descriptions which insinuate a rapid fall of the Khmer civilization in this manner would be more appropriately explained through notions of change or transformation. This was a slow and gradual process, as opposed to some climactic destruction. Although much of the city would eventually be abandoned in the 15th century, it was never completely uninhabited. In fact, Angkor Wat remained a functional religious site right up until it was quote-unquote discovered by French explorers in the 1850s. Now, I don't mean to get stuck on that point, but it is something that you see casually mentioned here and there, so perhaps it's worth mentioning here. How does one discover something if it has not been lost? There is evidence of statues being built at Angkor Wat in the centuries that followed the near abandonment of the rest of the city, not to mention the fact that it was a site of pilgrimage for Buddhists coming from other kingdoms in Southeast Asia, and notably, various Khmer kings made expeditions there on occasions prior to the French colonial period. Even when, in the 1850s, the French did supposedly discover the site, well, according to David Chandler, it was not like they uncovered some long-forgotten tomb. There was a prosperous Buddhist monastery still functioning, with several hundred adherents. Henri Mouhot, a French naturalist, through his posthumous writings and drawings, did certainly popularize or bring wider attention to the magnificent temple. But to say that they discovered Angkor is incorrect. This was, of course, detailed in episode 6. Anyway, while the exact combination of factors and forces which contributed to the transformation of the Angkorian period into what Professor Ashley Thompson calls Cambodia's Middle Period are not exactly certain, new research is providing evidence that variations in climate may have played a significant role. As we said, this golden age of Angkor was to a large extent built upon the surpluses of agriculture and population afforded by the complex irrigation and water management system built in this major city. Extensive years of drought, necessitating large-scale modifications of the infrastructure that they had already built, was then followed by unusually intense monsoon seasons, which overwhelmed attempts at fixing the problem. This may have permanently damaged the network as a whole, and amongst a few other factors, rendered the city inhospitable. So, what happens next? Well, as I said, the next period of Cambodian history relates to a transformation of some aspects of so-called Angkorian activities, like stone temple construction, grandiose inscriptions, and this expansive network of irrigation around a city close to the Great Lake. But 1431 should not be thought of as some conclusive date where it all fell apart. In fact, cessation of many of the activities we associate with the Golden Age of Angkor had already begun to take place soon after the conversion of the Cambodian elite and the general population to Theravada Buddhism, which was not that long after the death of its most famous monarch, Jayavarman VII. As Martin Polkinghorne has stated, the period after Angkor should not be interpreted in terms of absence. It was not a dark age. Perhaps the easiest way to illustrate the entrance into this era after the greatness period of Angkor, into the middle period of Cambodian history, is the process of migration toward the area near Phnom Penh as the new site for the Cambodian capital. Both Udong and Luang Vek would also become the royal capital at various times in this period, but they lay within 50 kilometers of Phnom Penh, which is the city that resides where the Mekong and Tonle Sap rivers meet. According to David Chandler, and among a variety of contributing factors for this location in particular being chosen, one of the more prominent is the shift toward becoming a kingdom based on trade. He says that by the late 15th century, it seems the social organization, bureaucracy, and economic priorities that were characteristic of Angkor, things like heavy taxation, forced labor, and the primacy of a priestly caste, were no longer strong or relevant. New forms of organization, new settlement patterns, and new priorities became feasible and attractive. By the end of the 1500s, weakness in relation to the Thai in the west was highlighted by the capital at Longvek being conquered. This period was also marked by the arrival of Europeans and some early forms of imperialism. One example of this was the tale of two adventurers, Bla Rui and Diego de Veloso, whose interesting attempt at bringing the Spanish into Cambodia was covered extensively in the fifth episode of the series. But at this stage, it was not Europeans that would come to dominate Cambodia, but rather a kind of turn-taking back and forth of protectorates which would come via Siam and the increasingly expansive Vietnamese. In the first half of the 19th century, Cambodia truly did enter a period of relative darkness, with alternating invasions from Siam or Vietnam, dependence on one or the other on the part of Cambodian rulers to protect the kingdom, as well as frequent rebellions and revolts. For a period in the early 1840s, much of its territory and affairs were administered as a component of Vietnam, essentially meaning that for a few years, Cambodia as a state ceased to exist. It's from these decades of Vietnamese dominance, as well as earlier annexations of territory, which today form the part of southern Vietnam around the Mekong Delta, an area still referred by many Cambodians as Kampuchea Krom, which even of itself sort of highlights a kind of resentment toward their eastern neighbours. This is epitomised in the infamous tale of the Master's Tea, a myth relaying the torture of Cambodian labourers working on a canal requisitioned by a Vietnamese emperor, buried up to their necks so that their heads form a kind of tripod shape that would support a teapot. The Vietnamese then light a fire between them, and when the men begin to writhe in agony, the Vietnamese are quoted along the lines of, "Ah, careful not to move, or you will spill the master's tea." Some Cambodians today still consider this to be more than a folktale, but that energy that they imbue with it goes some way in giving you an insight into this feeling of the Khmer toward this so-called hereditary enemy. So much so that Pol Pot's Democratic Kampuchea will recapitulate the story in one of the regime's official documents regarding their eastern neighbour. The anthropologist Alexander Hinton claimed that this story metaphorically conveys a number of Khmer nationalist themes toward the Vietnamese. It highlights their loss of face, the constrictive nature of Cambodia's geographical location, the emotional heat that the conditions generated, and that they harbour a desire to destroy Cambodia, that they have an evil nature. However, this state of utter dominance under the Vietnamese does not last forever. By 1848, following a series of rebellions in Cambodia, some supported by Siam, some more general uprisings, a kind of stalemate dawned, and the Vietnamese agreed with the Siamese to have King Duong sit on the Cambodian throne. This did not mean that Cambodia was completely independent of this back and forth between its two neighbours, but it was a brief period of prosperity under a Thai protectorate which was less interested in administering Cambodia to the extent that a number of Vietnamese emperors had been over the last few decades. By this time, however, from the 1850s, a potential avenue will appear for a Cambodian king looking to escape both Siam and the Vietnamese, and that will come in the shape of the French. In The Tragedy of Cambodian History, David Chandler argues that, quote, "Had the French not arrived to impose their protectorate on Cambodia in 1863, those parts of the kingdom east of the Mekong might well have come under Vietnamese control, and the area to the west might have been dominated by the Thai. As the French pushed Cambodia's neighbours back, modern Cambodia was born. End quote. But although, from this angle, the French colonial presence preserved a kind of Cambodian nation, at first under the guise of a protectorate, before incorporating Cambodia, Laos, and three states of Vietnam into essentially one colony, French Indochina, it was not an altruistic process by any means. I like to think of it in business terms, with a hostile takeover occurring, and the profits of the French investors being the bottom line. The French came to see Cambodia as a kind of changeless, timeless country, and the Khmer, a people who had become disconnected from their former glory. A history that the French would find fascinating whilst they decipher it. The French spent less time, attention, and investment in Cambodia as they did in Vietnam, whose people they saw as more inclined toward modernization than the Khmer. But while the French did lay the framework for a modern nation-state in Cambodia, it was one that was lopsided, underdeveloped, and ill-maintained. A political system of any real structure was ignored in favour of a top-down approach to power. The king was relegated to a palace-bound figure, and efforts to open Cambodia up to the modern world were rarely seen very far out from Phnom Penh or a handful of other major towns. The colonisation of the country was patronising and condescending. Any significant functions of the state were taken care of by Frenchmen, with Vietnamese preferentially imported to take on the tasks of medium and low-level administration, and economic life was dominated by Chinese Khmer. The vast majority of Cambodians missed out on whatever positives can be gleaned from the so-called civilizing mission that the French claimed as their raison d'etre for colonizing the country in the first place. Literacy levels and education remained extremely low, taxation extremely high. Whatever modernity was reaching Cambodia was predominantly seen in Phnom Penh, and it became a cosmopolitan, French-styled city in the middle of an overwhelmingly rural country whose inhabitants' lives were, for the most part, probably closer to their ancestors living 500 years earlier than those exposed to the 20th century in Phnom Penh. However, it would be unfair to characterize the protectorate and subsequent colony of Cambodia as a process that did not garner any form of resistance from Cambodians themselves. Rebellions against French rule in the mid-1880s, a massive demonstration against excessive taxation by rural and town dwellers in 1916, as well as the assassination of a French official in 1925, all spring to mind. But the vast majority of Khmer carried on living their lives in some form of a subsistence farming routine, in touch with the seasons, producing just about as much as they needed, enjoying regular Buddhist festivals, and the melange of spirituality associated with local spirits known as Nyak Ta, all of which we detailed in episode 7 via a study of Meiko Ebihara's work about a Cambodian village. However, though relatively smaller, there was a growing amount who did integrate themselves into the modernizing forces that were becoming readily available. One of those was a young man by the name of Salot Sa, born in a village known as Prexpal in Kampong Thom province in 1925. His early life was amongst the conditions we would associate with a relatively typical farming family, albeit with some connections with the royals. Able to take advantage of these, a 10-year-old Sa was sent to live in Phnom Penh, where he would be taught in a Buddhist monastery and a French Catholic primary school. It was during this time, in his formative years, that someone else would be laying the groundwork for later political figures, an early proponent of Cambodian nationalism, as well as someone who would call for independence from France. A man named Son Nhoc Tan, one of the founders of the first Khmer language newspaper, which is an indication to how far behind literacy and education rates were, as it was published in 1936. Son Yoktan represented a member of a growing number of educated elite in Cambodia. The paper wasn't particularly anti-French, but elements of Cambodian nationalism were espoused within it, notably a kind of Cambodia for the Cambodians, and a notion that Cambodians needed to awaken this kind of sentiment. This was at a time where more Khmer were participating in public life than ever before, and although still very small, more and more were attaining higher levels of education and even studying abroad. At the outset of the Second World War, scarcely few French would have guessed that their days controlling this particular region of the world would be so few in number. In 1941, the Cambodian monarch dies, and in an effort to maintain what was an obviously loosening grip over their Indo-Chinese assets, the French decided that the new king would need to be someone that they could easily control, as well as someone that they could use as a means of gaining more support from the people. They decided upon a 19-year-old prince named Norodom Sihanouk. As the war continued, conditions for change began to emerge. The Imperial Japanese Army began taking advantage of a weak yet nominally allied via the Axis powers, Vichy France. They stationed troops across Indochina and brought with them ideas that were incongruent with continued European colonialism. The idea of Asia for the Asians was powerful, regardless of the grim reality that Japanese imperialism entailed. As a result of numerous contributing factors, especially Cambodian nationalism and its growing ties to certain Buddhist schools, the highly visible Japanese presence, and increasing French weakness, the next milestone of independence occurred. In July 1942, French authorities arrested two monks suspected of subversive activities. Various reports have them espousing vague plans for a coup against the French, with Son Yoktan and his connections to the Japanese Imperial Police stationed in Phnom Penh also playing a role. The manner of these arrests was seen as a violation of monastic laws, and the French had committed a cultural taboo. The nationalists seized on this opportunity to stage an anti-French demonstration. At least a couple of thousand monks streamed out of the Watts in Phnom Penh, heading toward the office of the French resident superior. A riot ensued. A nationalist leader was arrested. Son Yoktan, having decided to lay low during the event, made his escape to Thailand and then on to Tokyo. The Japanese were apparently not as committed to the cause as some of the nationalists had hoped, and there would be no decisive result for those that wished to see Cambodia freed from the French right then and there. Toward the end of the war, however, as both the fortunes of the French and the Japanese began to shift once again, more opportunities arose. On the 9th of March 1945, Imperial Japan staged a coup de force across Indochina. Utilizing local militia units and regular forces, they disarmed and interned French armed units and officials. The young King Sihanouk read aloud a declaration of independence at the behest of the Japanese, who sought to protect their positions in what was quickly becoming a losing war in which their former French allies could no longer be trusted. David Chandler, again in The Tragedy of Cambodian History, writes, quote, "This action by the Japanese removed European observers from the Cambodian scene for the first time since the 1860s. Their unexpected departure probably convinced many Cambodians that something dramatic and open-ended was going on. Students in the capital, infected with what the French later called the virus of independence, included many future Cambodian radicals. The last 9 months of 1945 were a psychological boundary between two political generations." End quote. Son Yoktan is returned from exile and briefly installed as Prime Minister, beginning a strange dichotomy in Cambodian politics where the semi-divine ruler is displaced by someone who is supported by those that feel mere mortals also have the right to rule the people. But this independence guided by Imperial Japan, and indeed the future of Imperial Japan as well, is short-lived. Son Yat-Tan's government lasts until October, when the returning French, bolstered by their allies, removed him from power, signalling their intent to simply reclaim their Indochinese possessions. The French would soon find out that the task in front of them would not be so easy. In episode 11 of the podcast, I described the return of the French in terms similar to that of an abusive partner coming back to the family home after a stint in jail. They don't consider their previous actions as abusive, quite the opposite. They had only wanted to help, to protect, to civilize. But those who suffered under that abuse had grown in the French absence, however brief it was. Most glaringly in Vietnam, where Ho Chi Minh, leader of a nominally nationalist, yet very much communist, movement, known as the Viet Minh, had declared the independence of a country known as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1945. In Cambodia, there was less obvious resistance to the return of the French, but things had changed there too, and a union of anti-colonial groups ranging from bandits to Thai-backed guerrillas known as the Khmer Issarak, or Khmer Freedom Fighters, would begin isolated actions against the French in this new era of resistance to the returning European power. At the same time, the number of those Cambodians who had decided that Ho Chi Minh's model of resistance was most appealing began to grow. Two former monks, Son Yoc Minh and Thu Samut, had fled to Vietnam during the latter stages of the Second World War, and were the first Cambodians to be made members of the Indochinese Communist Party. The French had returned with promises that they had changed, and in Cambodia, they attempted to highlight this gesture by initiating some token reforms that would bring about the birth of a Cambodian electorate and political pluralism. A progressive party, the Democrats, were able to capitalize on a groundwell of support still left over from the nationalist movements prior to, during, and after the Second World War, and they quickly became the most popular political party in the country. However, this experiment in politics was little more than a facade for those truly in power, the French, and the constitution that was drafted still enshrined the king with a supreme position over politicians. So, who had the mandate to rule the country? For the time being, the French would still assume that position. All important aspects of the state, the economy, military, and foreign relations, all remained in the hands of the French. Meanwhile, attempts to crush the nation-state declared by Ho Chi Minh had not been completely successful. Although the French were able to remove them from power in the major cities, like Hanoi in the north, which had become much more of a stronghold for the Viet Minh than in the south, that was not the end of the story. Able to meld in and out of the villages and the countryside, Ho Chi Minh and his general, Vo Nguyen Giap, began a guerrilla war against the French. Before long, according to Christopher Gosher, Vietnam became an archipelago of competing government or anti-government forces, expanding and contracting even as the day turned to night. The First Indochina War began. By 1947, Salot Sar, a young man who, by all accounts, was personable, charming and funny, if not the best and brightest student, was able to gain entry into the latter stages of high school at one of the most prestigious institutions in the country, the Lycée Sisulat. He was not particularly political, apart from harbouring an admiration for Son Yat-Tan that many Cambodians his age had acquired. By this time, he had already come into contact with some future leaders of the Communist Party of Kampuchea, including Khieu Samphan and Yeng Sari, the latter of which he met at the Lycée Sisulat. Sari certainly was politically minded, and someone that we might consider to be in the role of the classic student intellectual. He will be attracted to the ideas of Marxism once he discovers them during his studies in Phnom Penh. Sar does not achieve the marks required to go on towards study at university, but instead elects to take up carpentry at a local trade school. In 1949, either due to connections to the royal family, his fluency in French, his friendship with some members of the Democratic Party, or maybe just some plain old good grades, Saar is awarded a scholarship to study radioelectricity in Paris. It is there that he will come into contact with a wider community of Cambodian students, including Keng Van Sat and Thiel Mum, two intellectuals who are shining examples of a new, young, and well-educated Cambodian elite. He also rekindles his friendship with Yang Sari, who arrives in Paris in 1950, and soon begins connecting himself with left-wing students as well as the French Communist Party. Following a semester break holiday in Yugoslavia, where in Salot Saar witnesses large-scale nationalised communism at work, participating in huge labour armies, reconstructing a country, the young man returns to Paris and begins attending student study sessions with some of the aforementioned people, and these sessions begin cultivating a left-wing, soon-to-be-communist, and actively engaged political agenda. That same year, the Cold War began shaping up in Indochina. The newly declared People's Republic of China and their comrades in the Soviet Union recognized Ho Chi Minh's government. US foreign policy becomes increasingly concerned with halting the spread of communism, what will become known as containment, and soon the states of Indochina are seen as dominoes ready to fall. The war for Vietnamese independence suddenly takes on a different and far larger role internationally. The decision is made by those leading the Indochinese Communist Party to widen their struggle against the French. The Vietnamese in charge of the body realize that Cambodia and Laos will need to be actively incorporated into their plans for independence. They will not be able to get rid of the French in their country without doing so in the rest. The Indochinese Communist Party is split along national lines. The Vietnamese Workers' Party, the Lao Independence Party, and the Revolutionary Cambodian People's Party. Son Ngoc Minh becomes head of the Cambodian branch. However, it must be stressed that membership of Khmer in the communist movement was not very large, and the Vietnamese were still very much running the show. Little thought was given, however, to the suitability, or unsuitability, of Cambodia to an orthodox Marxist revolution. Cambodia lacked an industrial class, enough trained cadre, even general communal organization outside of the Buddhist Sangha. But, at Vietnamese insistence, and under the presumption that any Cambodian communist movement would be subordinate to the Vietnamese one, the slow path toward revolution in Cambodia began. Increasing monetary and military support from the benefactors of the war in Indochina had the effect of turning the Viet Minh struggle from guerrilla tactics to something closer to conventional modern warfare. At the same time, the US began paying for an increasingly large percentile of the French war effort and providing them with significant amounts of materiel. Even napalm came into use. The war became as ugly as war can be. A kind of stalemate ensued, where neither side was able to control an entire country at the same time. Frustrations boiled. In one example that we discussed in detail, the village of Mai Trac was the scene of a massacre of more than 200 civilians at the hands of the French Union Army. On the other hand, killings by communists of those who were thought to be colluding with government forces were also becoming commonplace. In Cambodia, the previously nationalist-dominated Khmer Issarak began to be influenced more and more by those friendly to the Viet Minh. By 1953, vast amounts of the Cambodian countryside will have fallen into the hands of the communists. The return of the exiled Son Ngoc Thanh, whose nationalist heroics prior to and during World War II had still left him with a significant amount of political clout, only served to raise the tension further. Sihanouk, infuriated by the popularity of Son Ngoc Thanh, as well as what he and his French backers perceived to be subterfuge on behalf of the Democratic Party, aimed at undermining the monarchy and their monopoly on power, the king dissolved the parliament and began ruling by decree. He also proclaimed his own plan for Cambodia's independence, a royal crusade as he called it, catching both the nationalist and communist resistance efforts off guard. Meanwhile, The Cambodian students in Paris had become increasingly willing to participate in what they perceived to be a vital moment in their country's history. They began regular study of Marx, Mao, and Stalin. The basics of these doctrines was covered in episodes 8 and 9, although an extended look at Maoism is still to come. These students saw themselves as future leaders and made efforts to identify which independence movement back home presented the logical choice to throw their weight behind. By now a dedicated communist and revolutionary, Salot Sar volunteered to go back to Cambodia and ascertain this information on behalf of the student group that was now calling itself the Marxist Circle. Sar returned to Cambodia at the beginning of 1953, and after a brief stint with the remaining nationalist Issarak group, wrote back to his comrades in Paris, informing them that the real contenders were the Khmer Viet Minh. In August, having organized a passage out of Phnom Penh in the night, he left for the jungles that lay on the frontier with Vietnam, joining the Marquis, as it was known. The headquarters for the Khmer Viet Minh in the east, near a village called Krabao, were Spartan. The so-called credentials of the Cambodian communist students like Sar were not immediately recognized in the manner that they might have expected. Many lamented the fact that even though this was ostensibly the Cambodian resistance movement, it was overwhelmingly Vietnamese. But while they may not be treated as equals, they were introduced to many of the practical lessons of revolution, adding a Vietnamese tint to an already rich tapestry of ideologies which would influence the Communist Party of Kampuchea in later years. Sar will attract the attention of Thu Samut, who, as we said, was one of the founding members of the Cambodian Communist Movement and head of the Eastern branch of the party. Sar soon becomes his assistant and a promising and valuable party member, at the same time gaining practical experience on top of the theory that he had learned back in Paris. But there were others looking for independence at the same time, and the French had presumed that the 19-year-old prince that they had chosen to ascend to the throne back in 1941 would be someone that they would be able to control. Even when he announced that he would begin his royal crusade for independence, they thought that this would adhere to some glacial timeline that they would be able to dictate. This was a miscalculation. Sihanouk travelled abroad, to Paris to begin with, arguing his case that the French should bestow full independence to him, so that the communists or the Tsarists would not be able to take it by force. His requests were ignored, and then rebuffed. In Washington, he made his case to the Secretary of State, but was again told not to rock the boat. Returning to Cambodia, he spectacularly exiled himself near Siem Reap and began making almost seditious pronouncements. These somewhat dramatic displays were called the actions of a madman, but a madman of genius. His bluff, his popularity, as well as realizations on the part of the French that they were facing an increasingly difficult position in Indochina as a whole, well, all of this led them to relent to the king's wishes. On November 9th, 1953, Cambodia was granted independence, but the war across Indochina was not over, and the French were being lured into a battle that would go down in history. By 1954, the French and the Viet Minh had been at war for 8 long years. In France, public perceptions of a dirty war and a desire by successive governments to find an honourable end to the conflict were opening up possibilities for an end to the stalemate. The French planned to draw the Viet Minh into a decisive battle after an extended period of regrouping their own forces. This was called the Navarre Plan. The Viet Minh, learning about these intentions fairly quickly, set about diverting various elements of the French Union Army across Indochina. Near the valley of Dien Bien Phu in the northwest of Vietnam, the French began committing a large contingent of their army to build a fortified garrison in enemy territory. Sensing that the French had overcommitted their forces in this one particular area, and conscious of the growing international desire for a diplomatic solution to the war, the Viet Minh meticulously prepared enough resources and combatants to break the French so badly that they would be forced into a peace on their terms. Painstakingly surrounding the valley with artillery, the Viet Minh began an all-out assault on the French garrison in March of 1954, just 2 months before the Geneva Conference. Although they suffer heavy casualties, their plan is successful, devastating the French Union Army and inflicting a humiliating defeat upon the fading European giant. The negotiations at Geneva would prove difficult at first, with the Viet Minh arguing that the territory that they and their Laotian and Cambodian comrades had won across the three states of Indochina deserved to be recognized officially. To expedite these difficult proceedings, the Chinese delegation, led by Zhou Enlai, was able to convince his Vietnamese comrades to abandon their wider Indochinese ambitions. Not only did this serve the goal of ending the war itself, importantly keeping the US from entering the conflict, but it was also an early signal that the Chinese were reluctant to have an Indochinese Federation of States, ostensibly led by Vietnam and the USSR, on its southern border. The settlement at Geneva resulted in the bisection of Vietnam. The communists were to withdraw their forces from the south, from Cambodia, from Laos, and regroup in the north. Likewise, in the south, a new regime supported by the US began to take shape. The idea being that there would be a national vote in 1956 to decide the fate of the entire country. In Cambodia, as the Khmer Viet Minh had not been able to fully establish an official liberated zone in their name, despite having control of vast areas of the countryside, well, the country escaped any kind of territorial infringements or compromises with the communists. Sihanouk had been able to successfully make the case that any Cambodian resistance to the French had already flocked to his cause. All that was needed was for the Viet Minh to leave his borders. This meant that there would be no place for the Cambodian communists to hide in their own country. Although they were given hope that a democratic election in 1955 might provide a legitimate means for them to gain power, Sihanouk was in an interesting new position. Having won independence all by himself, in his mind, he felt that he should also now have the mandate to go on and rule his country. Meanwhile, in the Marquise, Salut Sar and the other communists who had thrown their lot in with the Vietnamese cause were left in an awkward position. Many of them left Cambodia and travelled to Hanoi with the Viet Minh for further training. Those that remained began living a double life, one part secret communist, the other regular citizen. However, another group was directed to form that official communist party to contest the elections. Salut Sar became one of those to begin leading a double life. The Democrat Party also saw an opportunity to win power in the upcoming elections, and the group was re-energized by new leadership, Keng Van Sant and Thion Mum, two of the left-wing intellectuals who had been part of those study sessions back in Paris. In the lead-up to the 1955 elections, reacting to the potential that he may be excluded from the ruling process, Sihanouk produced another bombshell. He announced his abdication from the throne. He was just Citizen Sihanouk now, and he himself was going to enter politics and create his own party, the Sangkum. Counting on the widespread support of a population which still viewed him through a semi-divine lens, as well as strong-arm tactics at the hands of the state's security apparatus and media, not to mention ballot manipulation, the Sangkum won every possible seat of the parliament. Sihanouk would later remark that the results were embarrassing in their magnitude. So, at the end of 1955, we have a situation where Sihanouk, king in all but name, has now outmaneuvered his political opponents once again. He is in control of his country. The Cambodian communists, to some extent left behind by their Vietnamese comrades, are no longer able to pursue their goals officially in the political process, nor do they have the ability to wage another war against the government. Sihanouk is attempting to find a middle ground in a new world order, one where nations, particularly those in the process of decolonization, are being urged to pick a side in the Cold War. Vietnam is pulled to either side of that divide at the 17th parallel. Cambodia, in the span of just a few decades, has transformed in many respects, modernized in some areas. They have been reintroduced to a version of their past via a colonial power, become a pawn for other powerful nations in a new struggle for global supremacy. And there are those Cambodians that have absorbed ideas for how their country should fit into the modern world, perhaps via revolution. A revolution that will be influenced as much by their own culture and circumstances as the foreign ideologies and examples that they've been introduced to. Cambodia is just 20 years away from the abyss, but the next few years will be remembered by many as a kind of golden age. The hurricane of history is building momentum at just the point where conditions seem to be at their most pleasant. And that is, of course, what the show will be covering in the upcoming season. As I said at the start, I hope this might give new listeners an opportunity to jump in here if they are interested in the modern history of Cambodia and how the Khmer Rouge come to power. If you are one of those new listeners, it might be worth pointing out that this episode was an attempt to cram in about 20 hours worth of the story into just one. There are many, many things I left out, mostly relating to events that took place outside of Cambodia, like the early history of imperialism, the French Revolution, and early contact with Vietnam. The origins of communist theory and how it was put into practice in the Russian Revolution and the subsequent formation of the USSR were also touched upon. I do think those are important points, particularly for the foreign winds part of that hurricane analogy. So, you know, if you don't know anything about that stuff, feel free to go back and listen. I guess the other thing you might generally miss out on, which is really a shame, are all of my over-elaborations and over-contextualizing. Some of the imaginative scenes that I've tried to conjure up in between the lines of some of those secondary and primary sources as well. Now, if you wanted to go back just a little bit, now that you have listened to this, I mean, feel free to listen to the whole thing, obviously, but if that's a bit much, I think starting at the Pol Pot in Paris episodes is probably a good way to go. If you are a regular listener, I hope that this kind of potted history of Cambodia up until here has been a helpful reminder for some of the things we've covered. As I alluded to at the beginning, obviously want to thank those who have contributed to the show via PayPal or on Patreon. If you would like to do so, links to the support page are in the description. On that note, I have released the first real bit of exclusive content for those that have donated to the show in the past or currently. I tried to email everyone I could find that had done so over the last few years, so if you are listening to this and you have donated but did not get an email, feel free to get in touch and I will respond with where you can get this exclusive content, which is a commentary track for the film The Killing Fields. I did a fair bit of background research as well, so it isn't just me sitting there, you know, saying I like this scene or I don't like this one. I get into what the movie doesn't show, what is real, what they've changed, as well as just some general context. It's kind of like an episode of the podcast, just set to the movie a bit. There are a couple of versions available. If you're on Patreon, naturally it can be downloaded from there or listened to on the app. And if you make a donation via PayPal, I will try and get in contact with you as soon as possible to send a link to the website where you can do the same thing. Oh, and one more thing. I was able to have a great correspondence interview with Lena Goldberg, who wrote the book Move to Cambodia. Anyone who has ever been an expat in Cambodia or even thought about doing so will no doubt be familiar with either the book or the website. But yeah, she was kind enough to reach out and give me the opportunity to talk about some things like why I started the podcast and how I'm looking to handle certain things going forward. So I'll leave a link to that in the show notes, or if you want to, there is a link to the interview on the blog page of the website as well. So for all of these things and more, visit www.shadowsofutopia.com. Aside from all that, thanks again everyone for listening. Until next time, goodbye.